Welcome back to the program. The 21st century, with the rapid growth of globalization, has witnessed one of the great migrations of history. Millions of people have moved from rural areas to the cities of the developing world. These cities, some of which didn't exist 20 years ago, have populations in the millions. In China, for example, there are cities of 10 million people, cities that we don't even know the names of. The growth of these so-called instant cities has provided great opportunity, but also pose enormous challenges, problems, and risks. One such city is Karachi in Pakistan, a city that sits not only at the center of the developing world, but also straddles the geopolitical fault lines of its region. The co-host of NPR's Morning Edition, Steve Inskeep, has been traveling to Karachi since 2002 and has witnessed this phenomenon up close and personal. In his new book, Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi, he takes us inside Karachi as a model of this migration that is challenging the world. It is my pleasure to welcome Steve Inskeep to the program today to talk about Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. Steve Inskeep, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's an honor to be here. Thanks very much.
It's great to have you here. When you first went to Karachi back in 2002, when you were covering the death of Danny Pearl, you didn't like the city very much.
Well, no, it took a little while to grow on me. It's really large. It's hard to understand. It can be even a scary place, and not just because of terrorism. I mean, crossing the street in Karachi can be a life-threatening experience depending on where you are. But I went back, I got to know some of the people there, got to know some of their stories, and I became fascinated by just the architecture, the different kinds of buildings in the city and the way it was changing. And I realized, as you suggested in your fine introduction there, that this is a story that touches on so many things in human life today. It's an economic story. It is a Pakistan story. It's a terrorism story. It's also a story about sustainability as we approach this milestone of having 7 billion people in the world. The majority of them are living in cities now, which is something that's never happened before in human history, that the majority of people are in cities. And all of this comes together when you begin to look beneath the surface in one megacity.
It also is kind of an edge city in some respects, because if you look at it, particularly today, every aspect of it, from its governance to its law enforcement to its infrastructure, is really being not only pushed to the limit, but pushed beyond the limit.
I love that comparison. You're referring, I'm sure, to the book Edge City,
right,
by Joel Garreau, which named these kind of suburban cities that have grown up on the edges of American metropolises as edge cities. And he meant that they were on the edge of the metropolis, but also that they were edgy, that they were unfinished, that they were under construction. And I think you're exactly right. I mean, we have those kinds of cities in the United States. In the developing world, it's a little different, but you do have these places that are new and massively under construction, and they're on the edge in so many ways.
The other aspect that you talk a lot about is the degree to which they become melting pots, that there are people migrating there, and migration is really how they've grown from so many different cultures, so many different places.
Yeah, there are several factors that cause a megacity to grow. One of them is just population growth, birth rate, births over deaths. And another is that the city expands geographically and grabs villages and towns that weren't part of it before. But migration is the thing, Jeff, you're exactly right, that makes them so interesting and so vibrant and sometimes so violent, because you have different kinds of people coming together, speaking different languages, different religious traditions, different anxieties, and there are so many fault lines. You referred to fault lines. There are fault lines between rich and poor. There are fault lines between different ethnic and religious groups. There are fault lines between old-timers and newcomers in a city like this, and they all contend for power and money and land in this landscape that is changing so quickly that it's unfamiliar to them all.
And yet the one common thread that seems to exist with all of this diversity is that people that come there, and even people that are there, are all looking somehow, in some way, for a better life.
Oh, that is so true. And we think of cities like this, if we try to think simply about them, as cesspools of poverty. And there is massive poverty in a city like this, and there is massive human suffering, let's not deny it. But when you begin interviewing people who are working a $3 a day job or a $4 a day job, and I interviewed people like this for the book. You talk with them, and they say, actually, I came here from a village in Swat Valley in northwestern Pakistan, where in recent years there's been a lot of fighting with the Taliban. And there are no jobs in Swat. And if there were jobs in Swat, they would hardly pay anything. And that's why I have migrated. I've come to Karachi, and this $3 or $4 or $5 a day job is not bad by comparison. And I have more of an opportunity to go to school in Karachi. And, you know, and I'm a young man, and I want to get married, and I have a chance for a better life here.
Talk a little bit about law enforcement and really what holds the city together. In many ways, the military plays a role as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is a large police force. It is not trusted at all. I mean, there are constant accusations of corruption. It is one of these places where if you got into trouble, the government is not necessarily the first entity that you would call, unless you were politically connected. The police are not necessarily the first people you would call. There's a great gap in trust between the people and the police. And you mentioned the military. The military is absolutely there. There are paramilitary forces in this city of Karachi. This is this huge, vibrant city, but often violent city. There are paramilitary forces who are used to keep order, and the military itself is not necessarily involved in the day-to-day security in the city. But this is something to understand about a lot of cities in the developing world. The military is an economic power. They're a big landowner. They own manufacturing concerns all across Pakistan. They have contractors that do a lot of work for different people, a lot of construction. They are a huge power in the economy as well as the politics of the place.
Unlike a lot of cities, these kind of instant cities in other parts of the developing world, particularly China and India, we've been talking about the diversity of a place like Pakistan. To what extent has the way in which that country was formed contributed to the diversity and contributed to the confusion that creates the problems that it does in a place like Karachi?
Well, in 1947, as many people will know, British India ceased to exist. The British gave up India, gave India its independence, and it was split into two separate nations, one of which we know is India and the other of which became Pakistan, and eventually itself split in two, and Bangladesh split away from it. And many of the problems of this city that we're talking about and the country that we're talking about do stem from that time. It utterly changed the human landscape of these places. India was supposed to be majority Hindu. Pakistan was supposed to be majority Muslim. But, of course, neither was going to be 100% anything because it was such an incredibly diverse subcontinent. As soon as the dividing lines were drawn, it was clear that millions of people were on what they might perceive as the wrong side of the dividing lines. Some of them fled to the other side willingly. Some of them raced to the other side looking for better opportunities on the other side. Many of them were chased to the other side and fled for their lives, and hundreds of thousands of people at a minimum were killed. This completely changed the landscape of the city that I write about. Karachi, even though it was in this Muslim country, was in 1947 a majority Hindu city, narrowly so, about 51%. There were also Muslims, there were Christians, Zoroastrians, all kinds of people there. Within a few months, the vast majority of the Hindus were driven out. And as it happened, the Hindus were the commercial class. They were much of the elite of the city. And so the city lost an awful lot of human capital and actual capital in a very short period of time. Then hundreds of thousands of Muslim refugees arrived from India. And they arrived in even larger numbers than the Hindus had left. And this city began metastasizing. It began growing at an immense speed. And that was just the first of many migrations that have continued to this day. And it's continued to grow. It's gone from about 400,000 people to something over 13 million.
It's interesting to note, though, that as the Hindus were driven out, as it became more homogeneous, at least with respect to the Muslim population, the city became less stable.
Oh, yeah, which I think is almost it's a parable of a kind for us all. You would think that if everybody was more the same, that they would get along more easily. You would think that taking this remarkably diverse city and turning it into, as it did, a more than 90% Muslim city would make it more stable. But in reality, that surface unity of people being far more than 90% Muslim, it's an oversimplification. It simply masked the incredible diversity that remained. There were varieties of Muslim religious practice. There were different ethnic groups, different languages spoken. And what happened was that after nearly all the Hindus left, the people who remained found new fault lines, as we were describing, new divisions among themselves, fought among themselves. There were battles to redefine Muslims, some of them, as non-Muslims, for example. There were battles between insiders and outsiders. There were battles between old-timers and the newcomers. And yes, it did become less stable over time, and it's gotten to the point in the last 20, 25 years where sometimes thousands of people are killed in a year.
To what extent does this kind of innate need for tribalism, particularly in Karachi, come from what you were talking about before in terms of the birth of the country and these identity issues?
Well, you used a word that in academic circles might be seen as a little loaded or taking a position. I mean, there's a whole argument, there's a whole debate about asking what are all the religious conflicts in the Muslim world really about? Is it really about religion? Is it really about tribal identity? Is it about nationalism? Is it about something else? I would just point out this thing. Let's use just in the ordinary sense of us talking tribalism. People do cluster together according to the kind of group they belong to, the kind of work they do, the kind of class that they're in, the language that they speak, the village that they came from. People do cluster together that way in what we could call a kind of tribal way. And in cities in any part of the world, it's utterly normal that they do so. I actually, in this book, quote Mike Royko, the great Chicago newspaper columnist, who describes how different ethnic groups in Chicago, when it was growing very rapidly and taking in immigrants from all over the world, they would retreat into their various neighborhoods, and if you crossed a particular street or a particular railroad track into somebody else's ethnic group territory, you might be beaten up, you might have bricks thrown at you, or you might be killed. And it was a brutal kind of circumstance, although a great city emerged from it, and that happened in America. It's a universal thing.
There's also the degree to which so much of this migration is coming from the rural areas, and people are entering cities, entering an environment of 13 million people that it's very hard for them to get their head around, very hard to adjust to without feeling that they need to seek out people like them.
Oh, absolutely. And just to seek out people that speak your language. And this is something that people who are familiar with the story of New York or of Chicago or even Los Angeles or San Francisco are going to be very familiar with. Karachi is a place where many languages are spoken. English is very common among the elites. It's really the language that connects you to the global economy. And some of the middle class has English as well. Urdu is the nationwide language and is the closest thing to a universal language there, but it's not universal. And then each individual province in Pakistan has its own provincial language associated with it that millions of people will speak, languages like Punjabi or Sindhi or Pashto or Baloch. And when you have these migrants coming in, many of them will just speak that language. And there are even people who speak little regional languages or local languages that are spoken in a single valley or in a few villages. And so you do have just tremendous language barriers and communication barriers that are a big struggle for people.
You set this story against the backdrop of one day, December 28, 2009. Talk about that day, Steve.
Yeah, it was a day that I think reveals a lot of the fault lines that we've been talking about, whether they're religious or tribal or economic or political. It's a day that Shia Muslims, who are a minority sect in Islam, held a march through the center of the city. And the march was bombed. The Shias are attacked an awful lot in Pakistan, and quite a number of people were killed by the bomb. And that was only the beginning of the tragedy of the day, because after that, men appeared on the street and burned a substantial part of the wholesale district of the city. Hundreds of wholesale shops were burned, many of them to the ground, And this not only deprived a lot of shopkeepers of their livelihood, but led to this huge controversy in the city. There were conspiracy theories swirling about who had set the fires and why, and whether somebody was actually trying to clear off the real estate for later use, because this is a city like almost any city where people think a lot about land and think a lot about real estate. And it became this huge controversy and, to me, a window into the present of this rapidly changing city and also the recent past and the way that it had grown.
It is that these battles that are taking place are as much about the traditional urban aspects of power and land as anything else.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we can look at a city on the other side of the world and think that it is so alien to us, but I just kept being reminded again and again and again of cities where I've lived in America and reporting that I've done on cities in America.
One of the other aspects, though, that seems to be unique in some respects to Karachi is the degree of violence.
Yes. Now, this is not the most violent city in the world. Let's be clear and be fair about that. If you went to Ciudad Juarez in Mexico,
right. You
can have 2,000 or 3,000 murders a year in a city that is a tiny fraction the size of Karachi. I mean, there's an absurd murder rate. New York City even has had absurd murder rates if you went back to the early 90s compared to Karachi. But what Karachi has is these outbreaks of political violence, assassinations and gun battles that can shut down whole areas of the city and sometimes the whole city for several days at a time. Kids can't go to school. People can't go to work. The bus system is constantly shut down because one ethnic group, the Pashtuns, are commonly bus drivers. And so when other ethnic groups get mad at them, they start attacking buses, and the transportation system has to shut down. It's a city that is just convulsed by violence and has been periodically for a quarter of a century now.
What does Karachi tell us about urban growth in the developing world in general as we look at a more globalized economy and, as you talked about at the outset, more and more people moving to cities?
I think that it calls attention to some of the fault lines that we've been discussing, and let me raise one more, the fault line between the formal and the informal economy. And it is so vast and so important and so visible in a place like Karachi. There are glass towers going up by the water where American companies, among others, have their Pakistan offices. There are nice restaurants. There are waterfront views. There's a beach. There are people making plenty of money, and many of them are in what we would consider the formal economy, where it's a legitimate business, and it may pay some taxes, although very few people in Pakistan do. And there may be some rules that are followed, and the law in some way may be observed, or at least people are aware of it. But there's also this informal economy, where wages are lower, and there are far fewer rules. And the informal economy in a place like Karachi, and any number of other cities in the developing world, is vast. I'll give you one example. In this city of more than 13 million people, it is commonly estimated that around half the people live in unauthorized homes, meaning that some developer in many cases has grabbed a chunk of public land, government land, a park, a schoolyard, something, chopped it up into home lots and sold them, even though the developer didn't have rights to the land, and he paid the police to look the other way. Now, there are some benefits, actually, to this system because a lot of poor people get those houses and they get housing out of it and nobody else necessarily was helping them with that. But at the same time, they're living beyond the law, beyond the protection of the law, and they may be living beyond city services. And so it's a far more tenuous and risky existence.
Corruption becomes almost a part of the social service system within places like Karachi.
Yes. Yes, there's a woman in my book, Parveen Rahman, who is an expert in these areas and works out in some of these areas, and she describes it as a new form of alternative government.
Steve Inskeep, the book is Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. Steve, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
I really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Thank you.